7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Howdy, Croc Nation. Dr. Tommy and Ellie here with you with another amazing Croc podcast. Do I say amazing because I'm amazing? Absolutely not. Do I say amazing because Angel is amazing? Well, maybe. But I say that because we're here for you guys, for our cancer survivors slash thrivers. Angel, we have a special night tonight. I am absolutely enthralled with tonight's guest. We spent a few minutes with him, getting to know him. And my God, Angel, what a special human being.
Absolutely. And here's the great part. It's like being in the World Series. You don't know what's going to happen, but you're so glad you got a front row seat. I'm ready for it. First pitch is yours, my friend.
Exactly. So our guest tonight is a very special young man. And before I introduce him and embarrass him, because that's the right that I have as the podcast host, I will tell a little bit of a story. And Sanjay, I love to tell little stories before I start the podcast. So my kids, I've been taking my kids traveling since they've been the size of Angel's kids. So we've been traveling the world for 30 something years. And everywhere I go, I meet a special person, and my kids now in their 30s make fun of me because what I say to that special person is I'll say, Joe, Susie, whatever their name is, I'll say, you're very special. I'm expecting great things from you. And I think that's exactly the truth when I talk about Sanjay Lachuman. Sanjay comes to us from a very interesting background, from Louisiana to College Station, Texas, where he distinguished himself, believe it or not, as a business major, but a healthcare policy, predilection. And now in medical school, going to be starting his third year at Mount Sinai. Amazing young man. His publications already, even as a sophomore in medical school, have touched some of the most important journals, most respected journals, New England Journal of Medicine, the Mayo Proceedings, et cetera, et cetera. This young man is going to light the world on fire, no question about it. He also comes from an amazing pedigree. His father is a physician. His brother is a physician. I'm sure very influential in his choices to go into healthcare as well as healthcare policy. And I won't say the most important. There's no one more important than his family, but a very important mentor is a friend of ours, Angel, Dr. Professor Len Berry. We know Len for years. I found him doing research on our first module, actually, was defining survivorship, and we got hooked up with Len. He couldn't be more of a gentleman, so accomplished. He's done more for healthcare than anybody I personally know. He devoted his entire life trying to not take the cold, titanium blade of business, and sort of make cuts and make life, non-human. Instead, he did the opposite. He softened that blade and really has dedicated his life to try to make healthcare and particularly cancer care more friendly, more higher quality, and trying to derive better outcomes. And I think Sanjay, that's a great pedigree to come from. So without further ado, Sanjay, welcome to the Croc podcast.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be here.
So Sanjay, we had a very nice conversation before we went live, and I thought it was very wonderful to hear your story, how you ended up at Texas A&M, how you, went out there to work with Len and to get your degree, and now in Mount Sinai. Tell me a little bit about, influences from your family, from your dad, and what first sparked your interest in healthcare policy.
Of course, it started with my family. I saw my dad going through training growing up. My dad actually went to medical school when he was 35 years old. So I kind of grew up in different places as he went through the paths. I was born right after he finished medical school. Then we moved for his residency at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And then we moved to Atlanta and then came to Louisiana. So I kind of got to watch that and learn from him from the start, which was really influential. And as I grew up in Louisiana, I saw, and this has really been pivotal in my thinking, I saw how our healthcare system in our state was so poor compared to other states in terms of outcomes. Almost every outcome you choose were ranked either 48th, 49th, or 50th. And what I really believe is that people in Louisiana deserve the same world-class healthcare as the rest of the country, and they don't have that right now. So I really want to dedicate my life eventually to going back to Louisiana and trying to improve health outcomes in my own community.
Well said and beautifully said. And I think that one of the things that interested me when I first found Len and what interested me to have you on to talk about your paper is something that's very dear to my heart. It's one of the things that drives me. And that's the broken system of medical care. And as you mentioned, in Louisiana and many other areas. Angel and I live in the Hudson Valley. So we're 70 minutes from where you probably sit right this second, where there's some of the greatest hospitals in the world and some of the greatest access to healthcare in the world. We're absolutely on the other end of that. We are in a rural community. We are in a community with a tremendous amount of minority, exposure. I mean, the population is very heterogeneous. We have people of all colors and all ethnicities, and it's wonderful and it's beautiful and it's very diverse. But we have the have-nots. We have farmers and we have very, very poor people, and there's a lot of health disparities. And one of the things that we do as an organization is look at the four pillars, what we call the Crocs, four pillars of inequity. And that's sort of the lack of informality. As you said, there's a lack of trust. People don't want to come into the system. Number two is that physicians no longer want to educate. They just want to treat and they don't want to talk. Number three is there's no accessibility to healthcare. And lastly, there's no approachability. So this paper, which is called Community Health Partners in Unexpected Places, hits every single, you know, checks every box in my interest in trying to make our cancer survivor thrivers have better access to healthcare. So that's about all the talking I'm going to do tonight. Sanjay, please tell us about your paper, how you became interested in the subject, and then, you know, just bring it home for me.
I would love to. Our paper, Community Health Partners in Unexpected Places, which was published not too long ago in Mayo Clinic Proceedings, is really all about how we bring healthcare into different spaces in the local community. Right now, when you think about healthcare, you think about it being delivered in clinics and hospitals, and that's where it's primarily delivered. And that's where we spend most of our money, is within clinics and hospitals. But we go to these other community spaces like libraries and shopping malls all the time. So our question from our team was, what if we brought healthcare into these spaces? So for people in the community who are the hardest to reach or who are most in need of care, such as people living in rural areas, like you mentioned, health systems and clinics and hospitals should look into these areas for partners. They should look at libraries. They should look at barber shops, dollar stores, shopping, any partner that they can kind of join with to say, why don't we bring healthcare closer to people and to people who need it the most, who maybe can't come to New York City where I am, where care is as good as it gets. So in our article, we describe eight different types of partnerships between hospitals and local community entities. So those eight are libraries, places of worship like churches, laundromats, barbershops, fire departments, police departments, dollar stores, and shopping malls. So that's a little bit of a highlight. And what we do is we share lots of examples of where a hospital has partnered with the barbershop, for example, so that there's a nurse in the barbershop or even the barber himself who actually takes blood pressures of the patrons. And then the partnership allows for that patron, if the blood pressure is high, to go to the clinic or hospital to receive follow-up care. And we know that these partnerships work, and we talk about those.
Wonderful. And I was going to say that you mentioned the problem with trust. Many times minorities, people of color, and people who don't have, the funds are very skeptical of the healthcare system. Tell me a little bit about that and how that might play into these partnerships.
100%. The reason we actually want these partnerships to exist with these community entities is because these community places like libraries and barbershops are trusted and they're frequented, meaning that people go to them all the time. You trust your local barber, especially some of these minority populations. They're groups that have been historically and currently marginalized, like Black men, who don't visit healthcare facilities as frequently as maybe other populations, but they do trust their local barber. So when a Black man comes into the barber shop and the person he trusts most is his barber, starts the conversation about blood pressure, takes his blood pressure, that's a perfect way to kind of get healthcare to someone who may really need it, but isn't currently receiving it because they're not going to these facilities that have historically marginalized different populations.
Very nicely said. You mentioned there's four areas that you studied. You looked at implementation logistics, you looked at funding, you looked at awareness, and then you looked at the operational, how to keep things going. Can you just touch on those four pillars?
One of the things we want to make sure we did in the article was not just say that these partnerships are good, but actually encourage health systems to kind of initiate these partnerships. So on implementation, a lot of hospitals may think, well, we don't have the money to do this. This is really expensive. And that's where I want to make one really important point is majority of hospitals in the country are nonprofit hospitals. Over half of all hospitals are nonprofit. When you're a nonprofit hospital, you don't pay taxes. And in exchange for not paying taxes, you have a promise to provide community benefit. One thing that we encourage, and I'm a really big proponent of, is for these nonprofit hospitals to look to these community partners when they're thinking about their community benefit projects. Providing charity care within the walls of their hospital is wonderful, but to really make an impact on community health, we believe that these nonprofit hospitals should look to partner with libraries, look to partner with barbershops. So we kind of give these ideas of how nonprofit hospitals can kind of make this work. And then we give, other challenges in our implementation logistics. So for example, one of the topics we discuss is dollar stores. A lot of people don't realize this, but Dollar General is the most, in terms of number of locations, it has the most stores out of any other retailer in America. 75% of Americans live within 5 miles of a Dollar General. And this is mostly in rural areas. This is remarkable from a public health standpoint, how many people live within this store. So what we hope for and what we say in the article is can we try to improve health through these dollar stores? Can we try to encourage dollar stores to, for example, maybe increase the number of low sodium food options? And if possible, sometimes this is just not possible, but if possible, bring fresh produce into their locations. And then a really big issue in rural areas is smoking rates. It's a huge issue in my home state of Louisiana, which has the third highest smoking rate in the country. And can these dollar stores potentially think about limiting the expansion of smoking products? It's really hard to ask a dollar store to cut out smoking products in terms of their revenue source. That's almost impractical. But can they limit the expansion of tobacco products? And that's where we discuss some of these challenges is how, and I welcome your thoughts as a physician, how do we encourage these different partners to kind of look to health systems and take on these initiatives? But that's a little bit about that section on implementation. We want these things to be practical. We want these things to be put in place.
And then awareness.
And awareness. One of the biggest things is you have these partnerships, but no one knows about them. So it's really important to kind of get the word out in a lot of different ways. And health systems, as anchors in a community, have the most power here. So these partnerships don't work if they're only initiated by the health system, and they don't work if they're only initiated by the by the local community entity like the library. They really take both. So a really great thing is if, for example, at a barbershop, there's a sign that said, like, you can get your blood pressure taken here. People may not even think about that. Of course, things like podcasts, radio, are all fantastic in health fairs. One example we share in the article is libraries already have a lot of health fairs. They host different things. So kind of setting things up in a library is a really good way to get the word out. Things that are going on in the local community can kind of be displayed in the lobby of a library, for example.
Yeah, well said. And then as far as the day-to-day the continuation of the operations of the project.
Sure. That's where the type of partner you choose is really important. So for example, for a barbershop may, they don't have the staff, for example, to have the clinical knowledge to be doing certain tests or to even interpret certain tests. So a barbershop for day-to-day operations may choose to partner with the medical school, where medical students, and this happens at UPenn, where medical students can actually volunteer in a local barbershop taking blood pressures. This is a great way for us medical students to get, kind of clinical exposure in the community. And it's a great way for the barbershops to kind of improve community health. So the day-to-day is one of the trickiest parts, but that's where the partner you choose is really important. Another example we share is with libraries. Libraries are already kind of part of local government. So a really good partner for them to choose is the county health department, which is also part of the local government. It kind of goes hand in hand. That way, operations are much easier than kind of creating something new between entities that aren't connected.
Yeah, no, I love it. And everything that, the paper is superb. So let me ask you this. The way I view things, and again, my view of the world is a very small slice of public health, but I am lucky enough to practice in a rural community with healthcare disparities and with issues with patients getting, so I'm looking at this beautiful, beautiful little table, or it's a little picture, and you have two different types of systems. You have a proactive system and a reactive system. You mentioned libraries. By the way, just to quote you in your paper, the majority of questions that a librarian gets in a library is about healthcare.
Yeah, many of them are,
which I don't think anybody really realizes. But on the proactive side, you have sort of programs to educate, to help people see where am I on the map? What is my blood pressure? I haven't had a stroke yet. I haven't had a heart attack. My blood sugar is not 700 yet. Maybe I can get some help to find myself on my healthcare map here. And that, I guess, would be the libraries, the dollar stores, the places of worship, the barbershops, the laundromats. Terrific. But then what I have a problem with is 99% of the healthcare that happens in our community is either through an urgent care or an emergency room. And people can wait in an emergency room for 18 hours without seeing anybody. So that's a totally broken system. So maybe you can help me on the more proactive or reactive side, reactive side, help me with some of that.
Yeah, it's a great question. Our emergency rooms right now are overwhelmed and overrun, and it's actually often by patients who don't need emergency level care. They're using the emergency room almost as their primary care. So this is a multifaceted issue. But on the reactive side, so many people call 911 for non-emergencies, especially actually in rural areas. So what we do is we share examples of how the fire department, the local fire department and local police department can actually improve a community health. These are some of the most trusted services in a community, fire and police departments. So I want to give you a really good example for all the listeners who will enjoy this. The fire department of King County, Washington, it runs a program called the FD Cares program. And what it's aimed at is caring for people who frequently call 911. So before the program started in Washington, this one county in Washington, about 40% of 911 calls came from 1% of the community. So this fire department saw this and said, this is a horrible usage of our time, our local tax dollars, and it's overwhelming the emergency rooms. These firefighters would show up for things like a fall that did not need, you know, fire department level care. So they created this FD Cares program, which is a special unit of nurses and social workers, and, you know, a firefighter here and there that work to address chronic health and social issues for non-emergencies. So what they did was they created kind of a database where they got all these frequent callers, and if it's fit certain criteria of, okay, this is probably a non-emergency, instead of sending out a whole fire truck and a team of firefighters, they sent out this special team of nurses and social workers. And, they would go in and they would say, okay, there was a little bit of a fall here, but what we need to do is we need to prevent the next fall. You know, it's like, what caused the fall? And they would try to fix the kind of root of the problem. And what that ended up kind of saving for the health system is it saves the fire department $600,000 a year, saves the local health system $1 million a year, and it reduces ER visits by about 200 a year, just by, you know, kind of addressing these high frequency 911 callers. And police departments are the same way. Instead of calling 911 and a bunch of police show up, you know, oftentimes what these people need is different social services. So we're just thinking about how we kind of mitigate the highest level of care when it's not actually necessary. And that may help the emergency room problem that you talk about.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I was going to say that you gave us a bunch of examples. I was going to ask for maybe a couple of more. You mentioned Cedars-Sinai's community outreach. You mentioned something over in El Rio. Maybe just yes. A couple of, really successful stories, to give our listeners some hope.
Oh, yes. I would love to talk about the public, the Pima County Public Library example in Arizona. People go to librarians all the time and ask them health questions. A lot of people don't maybe not realize that, but and libraries have so much space. And librarians love to kind of talk to people, and they want to help people. So the Pima County Public Library brought in a team of rounding nurses and one full-time nurse who is in the library who talk about health with folks. People could come up to them and ask them health-related questions. And, you know, of course, they would be able to do the simple tests like blood pressure and take heart rate. Just vitals were easy to take there in the library. Give a baseline of how healthy someone may be and recommend simple health improving activities. But then if that member of the community needed more care, they could be referred to a free clinic, which was the El Rio clinic that you talk about, for follow-up care. That's how this model works the best. Oftentimes blood pressure, for example, may not be able to be controlled just by lifestyle and just by diet. It may require, you know, blood pressure medications, and that could be done at a local clinic, which is a partner. And another reason libraries are really great places to partner with is when you think about the root of all the social determinants of health. And in my opinion, the biggest social determinant of health is poverty. Everything goes back to poverty. It goes back to financial insecurity. So, for example, there's the earned income tax credit, which many families qualify for, but about 20% of qualifying families who are eligible don't get the earned income tax credit. And we know that getting the earned income tax credit is tied to multiple different kind of improved health outcomes. So in filling out this paperwork, librarians and even volunteer kind of tax staff are great people to interact with. These forms may require like high levels of literacy, things that librarians have, but not everyone in a community has. So kind of bringing everything into the library, in my opinion, is a beautiful way to kind of improve not only health, but also improve financial insecurity and things like that.
Excellent. We're going to sort of corral you now into our world, into the world of cancer, into the world of cancer survivorship. So as you mentioned, some of the biggest issues are minority populations and rural populations and poverty, people without the resources to pay for their health care. And you named three major disease sites. You mentioned cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. So let's kind of focus on the cancer. Using your model of the proactive and reactive. So I love on the proactive side, what we need to do in our communities is to try to get people who are not in the, plugged into the system, do not have a primary care physician, do not have their cancer screenings, and get them plugged in. That's key on the proactive side. So here we would either have people, you know, not get diagnosed with cancer, but know they don't have cancer, or if they do have cancer, try to bring that train a little to the left and try to catch them at an earlier stage. So that would be, I think, really critical in all communities, especially ours. On the reactive side, I would love to see some programs put together in the community for our survivors, because the treatments that we give, you know, our survivors when they're going through their active treatments are very toxic. And there are so many times that a patient will be getting radiation or chemo radiation for head and neck cancer, and they can't talk and they can't eat and they can't swallow and they don't have a feeding tube placed because they don't, you know, it just doesn't happen because we're practicing MASH oncology medicine. And then all of a sudden they're in the hospital for 2 weeks or 1 week and they're go through the ER. Imagine if we had a place where they can go and get their fluids, get their hydration, have a have someone draw their blood and have a courier bring it to the lab, you know, check out their sodium, see how their kidney functions are. You know, I think these are all critical, you know, I guess, extrapolations from your study. Can you comment on that comment?
I would love to. And thank you for those beautiful examples. You're in it, right? You treat these people every single day. And that's one of the reasons I want to be a doctor. So I get these experiences similar to yours. One place where our partnerships actually performed cancer screenings were in the parking lots of laundromats. There's an organization, one of the authors actually founded it, an organization called Fabric Health. They bring healthcare into laundromats. Some of these cancer screenings are done in a bus in the parking lot of a laundromat. While people bring their laundry in and they wait for hours for their clothes to wash and dry, they can get these, you know, these health screenings done simultaneously instead of just sitting there and waiting. There's so much potential here. And the big idea is we shouldn't expect everyone to always have to go to a hospital or a clinic to receive care. That's not the only place where you should be receiving care. And that's not actually where we make people healthier. We make people healthier within the community, where in places where they trust and where they go to frequently. It's probably a whole lot easier for a lot of folks to get to a laundromat or get to a dollar store. And we say that you can set these things up in, you know, a parking lot of a dollar store. It's probably a lot easier to get there than it is to get to Mount Sinai in the city. So I love the examples that you share, and there are some really simple cancer screenings that you can do in places that are closer to home.
Yeah, I mean, we've been involved in, you know, skin you know, evaluations, prostate examinations, colorectal screenings, you know, mobile mammogram units and things like that, which I think would be perfect in all of the locations you mentioned. I don't think there's been any reactive community processes for our cancer survivors, but that's something maybe you and I will collaborate on that paper in the future. I wanted to ask you about, lastly, before we move on to the end, talk to you a little bit about three important subjects, two of which I think you can help us with, one of which I don't think anyone can help us with. So one of the problems that I see from my small vantage point is trust. And I think you have really done a great job in your paper. Just comment on that.
Yeah, and this is kind of the trust component of all of care, really. When you get to the even especially higher levels of care, like when you talk about cancer, as soon as you just say the word cancer, people get scared, especially if you say the word cancer in a healthcare facility. If a doctor tells you the word cancer or you're in a hospital. Hospitals and clinics are not what you generally think of when you think, oh, this is the of some people when they think of the place they trust the most. So this whole paper is trying to get at that, is trying to get to places that people trust. People trust their libraries. I don't know anyone who goes to a librarian and doesn't trust them. You walk into a library and say, this is a haven of education. We really need to think about bringing healthcare into these trusted spaces. I think it's so much less intimidating to have a conversation about a cancer screening at a library compared to in a hospital. And that's what we're really trying to get at here.
Yeah, and it is really a great point because from our side of the world, and Angel works with me at the hospital, unfortunately, and I think one of the reasons why we do this podcast and do what we do is because of the broken system and all of the terrible horror stories you hear about the way people interface in a traditional medical system. This broken system starts in your doctor's office, having to wait 3 hours to see a doctor. It's broken in the emergency rooms where people who need emergency room care can't get it because there's just too much volume of bodies that are in the way of them getting their care. It's also the lack of trust that we engender in our patients because of these bad experiences. Angel hears people call Angel every day, screaming at him, telling them their horror stories, and I'm sure he'll mention this when he does his bit, but just the things we hear makes us not trust our own medical system. So all these things that you're mentioning, alternatives and these very, very unique opportunities to partner. The second thing, funding. I have not met a person of means. And again, I don't know many people with means, but the few people that I do know who have big money means, I have never seen them part with money very easily. So tell me a little bit about how to get the funding, because at the end of the day, it's all about the almighty dollar. And if we had all the money in the universe, things could certainly be better. But as you mentioned, you want to make sure you spend your money correctly and efficiently.
It's a great point, and I just want to make one point about trust and money. How do you expect a community member to trust a health system that has repeatedly sued, poor patients, or sends extraordinary medical bills to patients who don't have the financial means to pay for it? You have these egregious examples of nonprofit hospitals, who have an obligation to the community, who are suing patients. And it's really hard to trust a system when you see that, or you hear about these medical bills that are crippling Americans. So that's another point on trust. With funding any of these initiatives is hard. And that's why I made the point first about nonprofit hospitals, how they already have to, they have an obligation to spend, money on community benefit. So we, instead of, kind of focusing only on charity care, when they think about what they should do in the community, we want them to think about these partnerships. So that's number one. Number two is it's really important when you start these partnerships to measure improvements in health. So if you're, for example, taking blood pressures or visiting older people in their homes, whatever program you kind of create, you really need to make sure you measure the health improvements, because if you can demonstrate health improvements, you can usually convince payers, insurers, that is, to pay for this care. So one of the examples that we share in the article is about Papa Pals, which is an organization that kind of accompanies and helps older Americans in their homes with different tasks. And because they've shown health outcomes improve, their services are actually reimbursed by insurance. So that's another way where you can kind of get the funding. And then a third way is the kind of traditional way of applying for grants, which is really traditionally the hardest way because this is so competitive to get money. But one of the biggest points I really want to harp on is that nonprofit hospitals, you know, really have to be providing community benefit already to kind of fit, kind of qualify for their tax exemptions. And we want them to think about these community partners when they think about their community benefit initiatives.
Thank you for that, Sanjay. I want to end by talking about the third subject, which I think has no answer, and that's our human nature. So we have Angel, this aspiring, wonderful, good-hearted young man who's going to be a doctor in a year and a half. And, you know, he really has this agenda to try to make the world a better place and to try to really make an impact on the care that people are receiving, especially people he mentioned going back to his home state of Louisiana and maybe changing those numbers instead of being in the 48th and 49th out of 50, maybe bringing it down to the 20th or the 12th or whatever. But the thing that's going to always, you know, be frustrating for all of us is that a lot of times, if not most of the time, people are not wired to do what's in their best interest.
Right.
And as someone who, you know, is beginning their career, I wanted you to comment on, and you've already learned this at your young age, how do we deal with people who just don't want to do better? People who are going to the laundromat, but have no interest in having their blood pressure taken. Men, black men who are going to the barbershop, who have no interest in getting their finger pricked just to check what their hemoglobin A1C is. And just, they're the ones that are going to end up with the amputations. They're the ones that are going to end up with the strokes and the heart attacks. Any comments on that?
It really is an impossible question.
I always end with the impossible question.
No, but it's a good question because it gets to the root of our issues. And I really think for an issue like this, it starts with education at a much earlier age. You know, this is where kind of my love and interest in pediatrics and children's health comes from. If a child grows up trusting doctors and trusting kind of people who care about she or him, people like even their teachers in school, if they have a supportive family at home, these are really the factors that build a good education that will then one day, when they're asked the question or talked about hemoglobin A1C or blood pressure and why these things are important, they'll be more receptive. You know, if you take an adult who kind of holds a whole life's worth of bias, you know, of internal mistrust in a system, it's much harder to change that person. So I think that the solution to this problem really is going to the youngsters and going to the kids and trying to improve their lives and their education so that when they grow up, they feel more of a personal responsibility in their health and understand the implications of poor health on themselves and their family.
Sanjay, to be honest with you, I've asked the same question to many of my colleagues who have had decades of experience, and I don't think I've heard anybody be able to answer that more articulately and to give me hope. Angel Santana, Have Faith, Let It Begin. What are your thoughts about this amazing young man and his insights and what he's doing for the world of healthcare?
One of the things that I think is the most influential part of this, and Sanjay, thank you so much for being on the show. And it's perfect because you hear my son in the background and I'm thinking about youth. I'm thinking about awareness. And I think that what we have just done is creating awareness. And one of the things that I hold you in high regards is how you are able to create this awareness. Because I remember a very famous quote that I was thinking about as you guys were talking, and that is, awareness without action is worthless. And this is what it's all about. And, you know, like education, healthcare is also something that needs to be given importance. And I think that goes hand in hand. So what we're looking at is the future. And I'm staring at a screen of the, forgive me, Tom, then and now, and what is the future in medicine? So I'm looking forward at my age of 46, knowing that there's a future bright and shining like Sanjay.
And he really is a great metaphor for that for the new that new generation of physician. And we were kind of talking offline and giving him a little bit of advice from the old man with no hair was going to be basically he's going to spend the next 10 years getting great at what he's going to be doing, whether it's anesthesia, pediatrics, what critical care. But then he's going to have that realization, which he already has had. And that's he's got to do more to make the world a better place, and he's doing that. Sanjay, I just wanted to tell you that Angel and I oftentimes, we'll have a podcast about something that's wrong in healthcare, something that's wrong with our cancer survivors, the way their doctors talk to them, or the way everything is just kind of on its head and not right. And we always go through the podcast and we say, all right, listen, Croc Nation. We've told you what's wrong, but we don't just tell you what's wrong. We also want to give you, ways of making it right. We always try to give not just the problem, but the solutions to the problem. You are the future. You are going to be one of the architects, and I have no doubt, a prime mover, of that architectural movement to try to correct and make better and fix the broken system of healthcare. The Croc Podcast, of course, is marginalized more for our survivors, our cancer patients, the toxicities of treatments, the problems and the fears and the inherent vices as it relates to cancer as a disease. But you are going to take it one step further for not just for the community, but for the nation. And for that, we salute you and we thank you for spending this time with us.
It's really an honor for me, and I thank you for your work too. And to all the survivors who are kind of part of your community, the one thing that strikes me the most about cancer is that it can affect anyone at any time and come totally unexpectedly. And I don't think that there's any word we hear that's scarier than cancer. So, the community that you've created and helping them every day, not only in your work as a physician, but also volunteer outside with this podcast with Angel is really meaningful and inspiring to me. So, thanks so much for having me on.
Sanjay Lachuman, thank you very much. Community Health Partners in Unexpected Places for anybody interested. Mayo Clinic Proceedings, published December 2023 in the 98th version of that journal. We are going to end this podcast like we end every podcast, first with a pep talk, and then with a bit of gratitude, and then with a blessing. So my pep talk today is for our survivor thrivers out there who have lost hope. And there are times when I feel that way, so I get it. And young men like Sanjay give me hope and give me confidence that the future for you guys and for survivors that don't even know they're survivors yet, who have yet to get their diagnosis, I'm very, very uplifted by the future that you have. There are people out there, believe me, like Sanjay, like his co-authors, like Len Berry, and like so many others who really want to make your life better. There are people out there who are going to try to find the resources for you guys in the community so you can get the education you need, so you can get the resources you need, so you can get the healthcare you need. I dream of a day when a person's color of their skin or their income bracket or where they're from, their ethnicity, their belief system, their sexual orientation, whatever it is, I look forward to a world that's colorblind and blind in all ways, except for the fact that we are all together in this human journey, and especially to our cancer survivor thrivers. To our board of directors, thank you for everything. Thank you for your gifts. Thank you very much for your wisdom. To Angel Santana, Have Faith, Let It Begin, my co-host and best bud, and all the other people out there who make this podcast a realistic and tangible resource for our survivors. And of course, Angel, we end every week the same way, wishing our survivor thrivers a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. God bless you. God be with you. Peace.